Our program today is going to focus around Mayan science and technology, Mayan tradition. We'll see it through the eyes of Dr. Edwin Barnhard, who actually excavated one of the great cities in southern Mexico, a place known as Chiapas, the state of Chiapas, and the ruin known as Palenque. Now, we're going to hear just what he discovered when he did a complete survey, the only known survey of this ancient city ever completed, the engineering feats he uncovered, the hydraulics, the water systems that go underneath the pyramid, underneath the buildings there of the general population, and also some of the details on this strange, what some believe is a human hybrid, Lord Pakal. All this and more today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, February 18th, 2023, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning.
This is Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Hey, good to see you. Hope you're doing well today. We are going to talk about one of my favorite subjects from the ancient past, that is the Maya, the ancient Maya, the complex and misunderstood Maya. And when I say those things, it's true. We have a really skewed view of this ancient culture because we're getting it from a group of people. These are archaeologists, anthropologists, who only have part of the picture. And I've mentioned this before. This is one of the reasons I'm writing my book, The Maya Controversy, is a simple reason that the academic community has flat out refused to work with the scientists that are still alive. The daykeepers, these are the people that are keeping an eye on the calendars, who are creating and updating new calendars, and understand better than anybody what their ancestors were trying to convey in their cities, standing stones, which are known as stela or stele, the pottery, the engineering, the astronomy, astrology, all the sciences that we are curious about and are noted in the other cultures of the time, which are the dynastic Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Chinese, the Aztecs, so forth and so on. When it comes to the Maya, we are getting this skewed half, well, I don't want to say half-baked. I would say of the data that's been released, it's probably in the teens, 12, 13% correct, but there's a tremendous amount of guesswork, and this is where the real problem comes in. My guest today is our own staff archaeologist, Dr. Edwin Barnhard, and he is going to take us through and give us some information regarding his time working at a city known as Palenque, which is in southern Mexico in the state of Chiapas. We've talked about Chichen Itza, some of the more internationally recognized and known cities of the Maya. Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Tikal is huge, and it's been excavated and discussed off and on. We've had other authors and archaeologists on the program, most notably Richard Hansen, who's in Guatemala excavating El Mirador, which is a monstrosity of a city, and he's just scratching the surface. Now, remember, in Guatemala, the biosphere was scanned, I should say a portion, and just a portion. A few, I think it's like 30, 40 miles were scanned, And what was revealed is 60, hear me say this, 60,000 unknown pyramids, ruins, temples, buildings, Sakbi, which are the white roads, the Sakbis. These are just being unveiled, and we don't understand, and it's shocking to say this, they just don't understand how complex these people are and where they originate from. Now, the other reason I'm writing this book is the fact that I was somewhat tutored on some of the Maya history, some of the traditions, and I speak of the untimely passing of the elder Carlos Barreros, who wrote a book called The Book of Destiny, Unlocking the Secrets of the Ancient Mayas and the Prophecy of 2012. Obviously, his focus was on all the craziness regarding the end of the calendar in 2012 and all the upset that that caused. But more importantly, the work that I did with him and another elder named Humbats was more focused on where these guys came from, where this amazing science, calendrical science, astronomical science came from. What do we know about the books that are left to us? And there's only four. They're known as codices. And there's so much that is misunderstood, that is viewed from a kind of a racist point of view, like, well, they're not really much more than Stone Age people. And this is one of my big contentions. When you read from some of the well-known Mayanists, people like Michael Coe, our own Richard Hansen, they have a very dim view of the Maya because they are excavating and tracking the most recent version. What we're beginning to find out is that there was a much earlier period of Mayan culture, earlier than the pre-classic. You know, right now we look at the pre-classic, classic, post-classic Maya, and they do that because it's easier for them. But lots of the technology, lots of the engineering prowess was handed down by earlier people. And I think we're going to be able to find some new research based on codices that are unearthed, based on new evidence in these LIDAR scans that are coming across. And I hope that at some point, a new crop of archaeologists begin working with the 6 million plus Maya that are alive today, because they can help us really get a grasp on just who their ancestors were, why it was important to be sky watchers and connect with the different constellations out there. More importantly, and we get this when we go to Egypt today too, and every time I go to Egypt, I am reminded of the pre-dynastic connection with subtle energy, which is Earth geomagnetic energy. The Maya had a real passion for tapping this energy. One of the big revelations of Carlos Barrero's book, The Book of Destiny, is there's a whole section in there on what he was told by the elders that he worked with on pyramid technology. At one point, I think it's right, 2,500 to 3,000 years ago, there were over 55,000 active pyramids. Now, what we don't know about the term active is, and he doesn't really know either, does active mean that they're pushing out energy? Does active mean that they are active in terms of being able to do ceremony on it? I think it's the latter. I think when we start looking at research scientists like John Burke, who actually conducted energy-sensitive studies on pyramids, and most notably, he was at Tikal and Chichen Itza and tested some of the pyramids there, he picked up on telluric energy coming out of these pyramids. In his case at Tikal, he was able to measure energy emitted from the top. I think the high point was like early in the morning, between 3 and 5 a.m. was the higher point. And it's a natural energy. It's telluric energy. So it's not like putting your finger in a modern day electric socket. This energy is more earth-based, so it's not harmful to us biologically. But what did the Maya do with this energy? This is an engineering feat that we need to understand. We need to begin to understand what's going on. So again, the perspective that we get from our current crop of archaeologists is just a fraction. And I'm willing to go even further and say their interpretation of the symbology is probably more of a guess and wrong than it is right. So here we go. We have a skewed knowledge. We have an interpretation of language and symbology that is probably off by a significant portion. We have a misunderstanding as to why they built astronomical observatories, their medicine, their engineering. Now, today we're going to talk about a smaller ruin known as Palenque. And this is where Ed did a hell of a lot of his postdoctorate and produced one of the most sophisticated surveys of Palenque ever attempted and ever completed. And now it's the standard that other archaeologists use and try to achieve in plotting ruins, buildings, pyramids, and so forth in Maya land. And this is referring to other locations. So today's program will be not only Ed explaining his experience there, but some of the real trippy things that he found. Like, they developed hydraulics. This is water systems underneath the pyramids, underneath the buildings, that are still curious to us today and extremely sophisticated for 3,000 to 5,000 plus years ago. Now, one last thing I want to mention. In the past, we've brought up the king's list of the Sumerians. We've brought up the king's list of the Egyptian pre-dynastics. And we bring them up because in the case of the Sumerians, they have kings going back 400,000 years. That's a little scary for the archaeologists today because that is a number that they can't relate to. The same thing goes for the Egyptological community. The king's list that the Egyptians present is tens of thousands of years in the past, and they basically just chalk it up to mythology. We're going to hear today not only about the great Lord Pikal, who is referred to in the program and also is buried in the tomb underneath the Pyramid of the Inscriptions at Palenque. We're going to hear about the earliest kings from a king's list that is found on the wall of the palace at Palenque. And this king list goes back over 5,000 years. And that is considered, and this is what blows me away, the archaeologists won't even consider it as a valid date, even though they have specific names that go far back. I mean, this one early king, Matt, goes back, I think he's one of the earliest kings, he goes back approximately 55 to 6,000 years ago. Most Mayanists will not consider that as a valid date. Well, why not? Well, because the paradigm says there were cave ape-like men, or they reduce Homo sapien to hunters and gatherers during that time, and they can't perceive of a functioning society during that time period. Why not? These guys have got to break out of their restrictive paradigms. It's just ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. So we're going to hear some pretty eye-opening stuff today. But the most important part of this interview is getting Ed's take on what he discovered and what happened during the 2.5+ years of his surveying this ancient city known as Palenque. I have a short audio from a program on Palenque that I'm going to play, which talks about Lord Pakal, but more importantly, talks about the level of sophistication and engineering prowess that went into building Palenque. Let's have a quick listen.
Palenque. Set amid lush forest in southern Mexico, Palenque is not the largest Mayan city, but it is one of the most stunning. Its architecture, sculpture, and carvings are among the finest this fascinating civilization ever produced. Palenque was also technologically advanced. A sophisticated aqueduct system provided the inhabitants with abundant spring water. In the 7th century AD, Palenque is ruled over by a powerful king, Pakal the Great. Pakal has the longest reign of any Mayan monarch. He ascends the throne in 615 and rules until his death 68 years later. During this time, he oversees the construction of some of Palenque's most impressive sacred sites, such as the massive central palace and the iconic Temple of the Inscriptions. Here in 1952, archaeologists made a discovery that gave a new insight into what the Maya believed about life and the afterlife. Excavating the temple floor, they uncovered a passage to a chamber deep within the pyramid. It contained a sarcophagus covered by a stone lid. Within lay the remains of a Mayan dignitary wearing a jade death mask. Hieroglyphs on the sarcophagus confirm his identity. This is the tomb of King Pakal himself. But even though it is a place of burial, it is also intended as a place of resurrection. The images on the sarcophagus lid illustrate a central Mayan belief that the universe is made up of three levels: the earth, the underworld, and the heavens. Having departed this world, Pakal emerges from the underworld and is reborn into eternal life in the heavens. This is the essence of Mayan religion.
Last year when we did our Mexico tour, we went to the National Archaeological Museum in Mexico City, and in the Maya section, Pakal's mask is actually there for viewing, as well as a reproduction of this sarcophagus lid, which is, I think it weighs like 10 tons. And this is the lid that a lot of people, following Eric Van Doniken's belief that it was the picture of Pakal flying in a ship, have made great claims to his potential hybrid background, that maybe he was an alien, so forth and so on. We've heard from Ed in the past. I mean, he's been, the bones, the remains of Pakal are shown to be quite normal. He probably had head binding, but there is a possibility that his genetic background does link to a race of beings. And I talk about this in my book, and this is something that archaeologists don't really talk about, and that is the multicultural, multiracial society that the Maya cultivated. And there's been a number of well-known scientists that have also commented on this I have a series of books on some of these guys, and they fill their books with images of not only the pottery, the figurines, the murals of these different races. And I'm talking about African-centric, Asian-centric, Caucasian. But there's also some races that I believe have probably died out. And one of them is a conehead people or a longhead people that had probably brain mass that equals 15 to 20% more than what we have. And we'll get into this later, but this is a very big curiosity of the Maya. But it also goes to the antiquity of these people. Not that they're a few thousand years old. My guess is that they are between 80 to 100,000 or more years old. In other words, there was an old culture that the archaeologists do recognize, but they cannot really understand them because their language, their hieroglyphics are not deciphered, they're not well known, and so they are in the dark. You will never hear about this in any books you read about the Maya. It's a big blind spot, and for them to admit it is a weakness, I guess, but it's also a huge problem. So lots to talk about. I think you can get a sense of my fascination with the Maya. Again, I had tutelage from elders. And so my perspective is more on the ground, living through vicariously these elders, but also understanding that their history is not written about or presented correctly in any books by the current archaeological community, because this community of archaeologists are today and in the past have not worked with and collaborated with any of the scientists, daykeepers, or elders who have been alive during the last few decades or are currently alive today. So really, really strange. So, all right. So the program today is with Edwin Barnhard, Dr. Barnhard, and we are talking about the engineering prowess of the Maya and the amazing design and functionality of this beautiful city called Palenque. A number of Mayan cities in the last 20 years, most of them in the Yucatan area. And I got to say, I have become even more fascinated by what I consider a lost art and not only pyramid building, but the civil engineering that goes into a lot of these places like Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Coba. One of my favorite cities is in Campeche, which is it's called Esna. And there's, you know, a lot we know about the Maya, but there's a hell of a lot we don't know. We only have four codices, they're books. Most of the other understanding is coming from what they call stela, which is these standing stones that are markers. Some of the other research is found in wall paintings, pottery here and there. It's been tough. If you're a Mayanist, it's been tough, but what an amazing culture. Today, we're going to head to South Mexico to a place that I've wanted to see for a very, very long time, which is called Palenque. I've invited Dr. Ed Barnhard with us. Dr. Ed is actually spent a hell of a lot of time there. And we're going to hear from him on some of the details. If anyone knows the intricacies of this ancient place, it's going to be Ed, simply because he surveyed the place. I mean, he didn't just walk around and go, okay, I think there's a building here, there's a building there. No, he got the hardcore equipment out. And he, I got to say this too, you know, we talk a lot about LIDAR technology, and it's blowing away the archaeological community simply because, in my opinion, it's exposing too much for them. They're going, oh my God, where there was one temple, now they're finding 50. And in some cases, there's 100 or 500. So they got their work cut out for us. So, hey, Ed, how you doing, man? Good to see you.
I'm good. Good to see you again.
Good. You know, let me ask you a question. What is it about the Maya that's so fascinating to you? Why do you consider yourself a Mayanist?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's not just one reason. But I mean, I admire and adore the culture, both the ancient and the modern people. You know, the modern Maya people are just the sweetest, family-loving, honest people I've ever met on the planet. And, you know, so there's that. When I, every time I go down there, I'm just, you know, surrounded in people who I genuinely like and care for. But the ancient civilization is just so amazing. Like you were saying earlier, you know, there's, you know, Egypt has 120 or something pyramids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and they are, when people hear pyramid, they think Egypt, but the Maya area has thousands of pyramids we already know about and thousands more hidden in the jungle. That's a big part of it too. Just the, you know, the challenge and mystery of just how much we don't know about this civilization is fascinating. And I suppose the other part is the hieroglyphs, honestly, the art. I love the art, but the hieroglyphs, I mean, they stand apart from every other New World culture, that we have written documents of what they thought was important and what they wanted to communicate to future generations about them, which adds this just amazing element. The their history in their own words is something that only the Maya and all of the Americas provides.
It's funny you mentioned that, because in Egypt they have standing stones, stela, with writing on them, but not as many as the Maya. I think there's so many more, maybe 5 or 10 times the amount of stela that we see in smaller cities, medium-sized cities. And of course, the bigger the city, they're everywhere, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, that's another thing about the Maya area. It's huge. I mean, very few ancient cultures, you know, we'll take Rome off the list, but they didn't cover this many regions and countries. You know, it's over 5 modern countries, and there's the Yucatan Peninsula, there's the jungle of the Petén, there's the highland mountains of Guatemala and Chiapas. So there, it's such a huge area, and the entire thing is full of cities. So if you compare how many cities there are in ancient Egypt versus how many cities there are in ancient Maya times, well, again, you see the stark difference. It goes from, you know, dozens to hundreds.
Yeah. You know, I want to mention, and we talked about this just off before we started, in Carlos Barrero's book, who I've interviewed, the Book of Destiny, his ancestors talk about the period of the early times, which is the old period, pre-dynastic Maya, if you want to say that, pre-classic, let's call it pre-classic. And he says in his book that at its peak, 55,000 pyramids were active. 55,000. So I'm telling you, we got to get this LIDAR going, because
I have no doubt that's a reasonable number.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you, when you read something like that, and I would consider you a field archaeologist. You're out there, you know, with your machete cutting through the leaves and branches. When there's some claim like that, it's a possibility, because, and I want your opinion. This is something I want to ask you, Ed. most of the ruins, Mayan-based ruins I've been to, are only partially exposed. As an example, Chichen Itza maybe isn't it like 12% exposed? And the rest of it is everywhere an extended landscape, right?
Oh, yeah. I would be surprised if the number was as high as 12% of the things that are the publicly accessible parts. I mean, it was a city, the population estimate is somewhere around 35, 40,000 people. And it,
yeah,
I've seen maps of at least the archaeological extent of the city. And the, you know, the pyramid in the middle looks like a little speck compared to this huge settlement area. So, yeah, I mean, there's, and every one of those are full of neighborhoods with little pyramids. You know, you get into a semantic argument. What's a pyramid? What's a temple? What's a house?
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of just large structures, let's say, you know, strip away the word pyramid, you know, 55,000 is probably a seriously low estimate of major buildings throughout the Maya area.
Yeah.
The other part he said is active, 55,000 active pyramids. And that's interesting because I like, you know, Carlos was steeped in the tradition of Maya daykeeper up in the highlands.
Yeah.
And so when they talk about the modern shrines that the daykeepers use, each one of them, there's supposed to be 260 of them spread out around the highlands and down into the jungle, but one for each one of the days of the Solkine calendar. But when they talk about them as active shrines, because occasionally they do, for whatever reasons, either close them on purpose or they get closed by, you know, a mudslide or whatever. So there are dormant sites and there are active sites where people are conducting daykeeper rituals to contact the powers that be.
That's so funny you mentioned that.
He's talking about, you know, active, like that's a place where we're connecting to the other world.
That's so funny, Ed, that you bring that up, because one of my mentors was a daykeeper named Humbots Min, who a lot of people think he was a charlatan, but I mean, I really learned a lot from him and Carlos. And before he passed away a few years ago, he would actually say to people, and to me, he would say that we are reactivating certain temples at a certain site. And I think these were some of these. He was in Mérida, so these were temples that were in northern Yucatan. But when he said that, it was an energetic thing. What is that to you as an Orthodox archaeologist when they say, I am going to reactivate it? To me, I think of John Burke, and somehow they're, you know, putting coal in the engine or something. I don't know. That's pretty raw. I mean, but when they say activate, is it more for you is it your understanding? Is it more shamanistic when they're working with the elements and reconnecting with the old ones in a different realm, or what? What do you say?
Yes, I think it's more shamanistic, as you say. Now, you know, as an Orthodox archaeologist, I'd have to quit the conversation right now.
Leave the room.
We don't have any archaeological, we don't have any artifacts that say that. It's done. Conversation's over. But if we believe that, you know, the modern Maya have things to teach us about what the ancient Maya did, then yes, I think it's a spiritual activation. I kind of see it as like a line of communication between this world and the other world. It's a communication route. It's a telephone that they activate. And I think that in the ancient times, there were lots of things that could get activated. There could be monuments that were to ancestors. Those would be activated as places that you could actually connect spiritually to that ancestor. Buildings would be activated. We as Maya archaeologists have a very typical thing we find that we call termination rituals. Mm-hmm. You know anything about those? You ever heard that term, termination ritual?
No.
It's things that we see them doing again and again that destroy a building or a monument or, you know, anything they made, they destroy it. And we call that a termination ritual. Buildings, when they end a temple and they're going to build another one on top of it.
Oh, interesting.
We'll find inside of it all this burning, and we'll find like odd figurines and objects, and they'll rip parts of the building down and like pile them up and burn them.
And so as you're actually excavating a temple on the surface and you're digging down a few feet, you may see the beginnings of an earlier temple, and there you have this ending artifacts and symbology left by the new builders.
Right. As part of that now encapsulated prior phase, the superstructure, the temple, will oftentimes have this termination ritual where they're burning things. They also do things like, if you walk around and look at Maya Stela, even just look at them on the internet, you'll see again and again that they have their nose pecked off and their eye. And some people think that's graffiti or defacement, but at least Linda Shealy and her crowd believed that that was another form of termination ritual. That when they carved the image of that person, that was a conjure point that was activated as a touch point between the earthly realm and that person's spirit, but that life is cyclical and everything that's brought to life needs an end. And so they would peck out the eye and knock off the nose to release the spirit and deactivate that particular monument or building.
I've kind of heard vague references to that, but I would like to ask you something that was kind of ingrained in me. And I'm curious about, of course, this is someone esoteric, shaman esotericism, which is that the Maya believe that everything is alive. And a building can be alive, stones can be alive, obviously birds, animals are alive, but energetically, the consciousness, and it's like, I have this strange feeling that they, in some capacity, were able to imbue knowledge in their buildings. And that sounds really off the cuff. You're probably going, what are you talking about? But it could be more that, as you say, they in ceremony, they anoint a new building, or they place a new building over an older building because there's new knowledge they want to release. And so, and I mean, a lot of these older cultures were building on much earlier ruins. And this happens in England as well. But what do you say to the idea that everything is alive?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I've heard modern Maya say it in quite those terms, though certainly everything can be alive and they can activate things. Yeah. So I think there's at least some of that. I don't know whether I know it well enough to say it's, you know, as core a principle as it is in, say, Buddhism. Yeah. Buddhism really is everything is alive. I don't know whether I can say I know the Maya are saying the same sort of thing, but a form of that for sure. And as far as, you know, kind of encoding new things, adding information, I mean, I believe, and of course, you know, it's my job to theorize about these things. They're not, you know, I'm not saying anything emphatically, but my theory understanding of it is that the other world is the place where all the knowledge from the past and things that we don't understand are at. And so the buildings and the monuments are the telephones through which you call that, you know, in modern terms, the other world is the hard drive. Yeah. All the stuff is there, but you got to get to it and you got to ask the right questions.
I mean, I don't know if you've been into certain rituals or you even thought about it, but obviously if a building is kind of like the telephone leading to the new, to the other world, there must be a meditation or a chant or some shamanistic ceremony that connects the two.
Yeah. And I think that modern day daykeeper ceremonies are exactly that. They make a place, they have a fire, they're putting things in there. And as they walk around, they chant, they speak out all the days of the calendar, and they talk to the four directions, and they talk to the mother, father, or grandfather, grandmother spirits. And they activate it through their words and actions over a repeated and long period of time. I've had some very nice day keepers who have done just an hour or two worth of a ceremony for my little American groups, where normally they go 6 to 8 hours. But I was like,
we can't. No one has the patience.
It'll kill them. Can you do a shorter one?
That's so funny. I want to get into details on Palenque here. This is the show for that.
Sure.
But before we do that, I want to ask you, the first time I was in Chichen Itza was 1995. And I was with Humbots, and he was also a tour guide at that time at the park, making a few extra bucks. I climbed El Castillo, the main pyramid, when you could do that. And at the top, I was with my girlfriend, and we both felt, and I'll never forget this, this weird surging of energy passed through us. It was like we were standing on the top of a battery. And that, the only way I can explain it is that something had zapped me, and it threw me off so much that I couldn't really, because that's a steep climb down there.
Yeah.
At that time, they didn't have the rope to hold on to. Remember the days when they had the rope?
Yep.
So I was up there, and I had to stay up there for 30 minutes because I was so out of it. And then probably 20 years later, I was told by him, Humbots, that NASA had cordoned off the whole pyramid because they were running some kind of electromagnetic testing on the pyramid. And it came out later, and it was through INAH, the archaeological community from Mexico, that some kind of testing was done underground in the middle and at the top of the pyramid. Do you know anything about this testing that went on at all?
Not directly as you relate it, though. I mean, there are pieces that sound familiar. I know we have done testing underneath it, and there is a cenote underneath
it. For sure, with running water, apparently.
Cenote underneath it. There's also one under the Osario, which is like the earlier kind of pre version of that one.
Okay.
And I also do know that somewhere, right around that time period, like early 2000s, there was a NASA funded Maya archaeoastronomy thing. So NASA was in the area and doing Maya things that time period. Now, what story that Humbots Men told you, I never heard anything about that, but I will say they have tested underneath, and NASA was around about the time you say.
So maybe that was a confusion. Like
cutesy little programs to teach Maya kids and the world about ancient astronomy.
Okay, so it was an archaeo and astronomy kind of a focus is what you're suggesting.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting that that I had that experience, and I'll never forget it.
do you know that a famous archaeologist was struck by lightning on the top and died?
No.
Yeah, his name was Denny Polson. He was a smart guy, a big researcher down in Tikal. And the mythological story that archaeologists say is that Denny for sure was there with his family, and that it was a rainy day, and they went all the way up to the top, and Denny jokingly said, "Give me your best shot, Chalk," and got struck by lightning.
He
did get struck by lightning. Whether his kids witnessed it or not, that might be elaboration. But he did get struck by lightning on top of the Castillo and died there.
Oh, my God. I should let our listeners know that Shak Mu, Ed was referring to Shak, is the rain god. And so this archaeologist was messing with the wrong god, I guess. So he actually was killed, huh?
He died by being struck by lightning.
Oh my
God. On top of Chichen Itza's Castillo. It is the most famous Maya archaeologist death. Everybody knows.
I thought he would fall into the cenote where Thompson was doing all his,
That kind of electricity pull you were talking about. Well, he got the full thing.
He got the full dose. Wow. I never heard of that. That's crazy. Let's go to our topic today, which is Palenque. as a student was, and by the way, for those of you listening, Ed was, one of his professors was the famous Linda Shealy. I adore Linda Shealy, not only because she's a good writer, but she, before she became an archaeologist, she was an artist. And so she's much more open to the possibilities of other, whatever, theories, worlds, whatever. And obviously, it was a big influence on Ed. But when did you begin becoming interested in Palenque? Was it under Shealy's watchful eye? Did she invite you down as a grad student to check it out? And we'll talk about your survey work next. But how did your interest begin?
Well, Shealy was a big part of it, though really Shealy's influence on me was when I was working as a field school student in Copan. That's where I met her, and I knew Copan. She was going to Palenque, to the Palenque Roundtable that she was a big part of every year back in those days in the 90s. And I and a high school buddy actually hitchhiked and made our way by bus down to Mexico and attended that conference in Palenque, but we just paid at the door. I wasn't sure whether we were going to make it or whatever, and Linda didn't barely recognize me back then, but yes, I did. Linda's the one who drew me to Palenque in the first place to go see this conference as a not even a graduate student. I had just graduated undergraduate, and I just really liked Mexico, so I convinced a buddy to go down there to Palenque with me.
So what was your dissertation on? Was it on specific Mayan lifestyles? Was it on Stele? What was your focus?
It was on Palenque. It was the
It's okay.
The map of Palenque. It's urbanism. In fact, you know, for your listeners, it's my dissertation is for free on my website, as is really reasonably high resolution maps of Palenque. The maps that I made and my dissertation are for free on my Maya Exploration Center website. So, you know, you might put a link in your show notes and
that's a great idea. So you can actually, is it a PDF that they download?
Yeah, they're PDFs. Download. Okay, so
yeah. For those of you listening, a PDF is much easier to download than a Microsoft Word document. So that sounds great. Let's talk about the inception. I looked this up. The current thinking, and this is very, very, very open to suggestion. The current inception date of Palenque is roughly 200 BC, or around 3,000 years ago. Now, when we hear that date, that's based on what, Ed? Is that based on pottery shards? Is it based on a stele that says we founded this place at this date, which is unlikely? But how do we know? How do we figure this date?
Well, that one in particular I know is ceramic shards. It comes from Robert Ranz's early studies of the ceramics. He made the ceramic sequence at Palenque, and the oldest were, you know, somewhere around there. The other thing that we have with the Maya is hieroglyphics, right? So we know that there was a first king of the dynastic sequence crowned in, 431 CE. So that's like 600 years after what you're talking about. But that's by the time, you know, a community doesn't just start with a king. There are people, it's got to work up from village to community to, hey, we should have a king. So those numbers totally jive. In that particular case, the glyphs and the archaeology support each other rather well. Unless, of course, you want to take this weird king that's mentioned in the Temple of the Cross that's from 937 BC.
Okay, you brought this up, so I'm going to bring it up too. So I was waiting to talk about this. This is what's very important. In Sumerian culture, in Egyptian culture, we have these kings lists. Now, the Sumerians get out of hand, I think. They go 400,000 years in the past,
Do they? I didn't know that.
With five kings that some of them were ruling for 25,000 years. I mean, that's insane.
Mythological founders.
Mythological. But if we look at the kings list of the Egyptians, that goes back almost 50,000 plus years, and there's a succession of kings. Because we can't bend our minds to an organized civilization being older than around 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, those are all considered mythology. When it comes to Palenque, and I just found this out, one of the earliest kings is a guy named Mawu Mat, and he reigned around 2325 BC. And he's considered mythology because the orthodoxy, I'm sorry, Ed, that's you, says that this is impossible for a sophisticated society to be functioning at that time frame because our paradigm does not allow that. And I will mention this before I ask for your answer or your response to this is there's two other kings. One is named Ushkin Chan, who reigned at 987 BC. And then another one that is very questionable. And the only wording we found for him is a guy named Casper. And he reigned at 252 BC. So what do you say about that? Because if we look at Matt, at 2325 BC, that's around the old kingdom of Egypt period. So that couldn't be that far off. But as a Mayanist, I guess you only can go as far as you can go. I don't want to put you up against the wall, friend, but
No, I know the texts of Palenque very well. I mean, I have studied these for well over a decade, so I'm very well in command of what all the texts at Palenque say. Now, there's the trick. I mean, just because we can read them, that doesn't mean we understand them.
Yeah.
Just because we can read out the words doesn't mean that we can cleanly separate out what they're talking about that's mythological or propaganda for whatever reasons and what's historical.
Yeah.
So, for the example of these two that you're talking about, it's funny. You almost got to the point where we're calling them Matt and Sean. So Matt and Sean, Matt came first. And then, thousands of years later, there was Sean. Here's my understanding of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Especially in the Temple of the Cross that Khanbalam built, he has this whole text that goes through from his dynastic founder, the one he's related to, up to himself. So we have this long list, like a king's list from Egypt, and the glyph repeats again. And then he was in reign, and then it turned to him, and then it turned to him. And we've got pretty much the whole dynasty historically. But the text, before it gets to that, talks about the guy from 987 BCE and talks about what we understand as the mythological founders of Palenque. And they are Muan Mat, as you're talking. That's actually a woman who gives birth to three gods, which we boringly call gods 1, 2, and 3. But they're the Palenque triad. And so we know from that same text that she is actually born before the fourth creation. The fourth creation of Maya starts in 3114 BC, August 11th. Very specific. That's when it started. She is born before that and conceives the triplets, the boys, the three, in 3121 BCE. So just a few years before the fourth creation starts, but she lives through it. And then she starts giving birth to the boys over like a 50 year period or something. The first one comes out at like 2350 BC and then the next two. So we have God 1, God 2, God 3. One of the reasons we suspect that that's a mythological statement is the fact that that would make her gestation period holding those boys not 9 months, but 764 years.
Okay.
That's a pretty long gestation period. Probably not natural.
Okay. It's still curious, though, that there is a King's List. I actually looked at it the other day.
Let me tell you one. Let me interrupt and just before
we go ahead,
because I did not talk about the middle guy. He's the one that's interesting to me. Ukit-chan, I think.
Ukit-chan, 987 BC.
See, there's the weird one. You know, we've got this mythological woman who branches the third and fourth creations and her three that are probably at least partially propaganda from Pakal, Khan Balaam's dad. But that's another story. But the 987, what the heck is that guy doing there? They don't tell us a whole lot about him. They just tell us he's the king of Palenque in 987 BCE. And the weird thing is that that is like the height of the Olmec site of La Venta, which is not far from Palenque.
That's so weird.
And so what is it's totally legitimate that there were major civilizations and interactions between sites going on at that time. It was just Olmec and Maya. So, yeah,
but isn't the general thought of that time period? Richard Hansen mentions this all the time. When you go back that far, you guys are starting to talk about hunters and gatherers. Well, come on. It's probably not that. It's just probably a missing epic. We need to find a CODIS, don't we, Ed?
Well, you know, here's a middle ground there. I mean, there's civilization and there's hunter-gatherers in this dichotomy. But civilization doesn't just evenly carpet the entire region all at once. It starts in little nodes. It starts in little cities, and things start happening, and they start communicating, and then it grows into a larger and larger civilization. I mean, arguably, the United States, middle of the United States, is still full of a whole lot of hunters and gatherers. You know, there's a lot of very unsophisticated parts of our great civilization, the United States, and I think a parallel can be drawn in the Maya world. Yes, there were probably some pretty podunk ass places, but there were also Palenques and La Ventas at the same time.
I just think that you can't help it. You got to have something to grasp onto. Using the pot shards as the indicator of the inception for Palenque, when we're both speculating that it could be significantly older, especially if it's contemporary with the Olmec, who go way the hell back in time. You know, one of the things that Hansen, we don't want to veer off too quickly. Hansen believes that the Olmec were contemporaries with the Maya, and he has but that goes way back, and that's not in our history books. We're not teaching that in our history right now, so we're a little behind.
Nope, we're not. I'm about to do a whole new series on the Olmec for Wonderim, though. I'm about to start putting that together, so hopefully I'll do my part in clearing some of that up.
We might pick you up on that here on Earth Ancients.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will return with my guest today, Dr. Edwin Barnhard, and we're talking about the Maya, specifically Palenque. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Dr. Ed Barnhard. He is a field archaeologist and has done significant survey work as well as excavation of Palenque, a very old Maya city in the state of Chiapas, Mexico.
Okay, let's talk about your work at Palenque. As you got there and began looking at it, we do know now that Alberto Ruiz had excavated Palenque starting in 1945. He was the key guy to not only, you know, begin working with the pyramids, the temples, what we know there. His biggest claim to fame was his discovery of Lord Pakal's tomb in the Temple of Inscriptions. We don't want to talk about that too much. We've already brought that up. We just want to kind of highlight that. So here you are, freshly out of grad school. Give us the steps leading to your surveying this ancient city.
Okay. Well, one thing right off the bat, I wasn't out of grad school. I was in grad school. This was my dissertation project.
Oh, your survey was a dissertation. Okay.
Right. So I was a graduate student at the time at the University of Texas under Linda Shealy. And and so I got the job really because at another Palenque roundtable, there was a late night discussion kind of over tequila among the INA archaeologists, especially the head of archaeology was giving the tenured archaeologist at Palenque a hard time that nobody had ever made a map. And why hadn't Arnaldo made a map? And my friend Chris Powell spoke up in this party and said, my friend Ed's showing up tomorrow and he makes great maps. And the head of INA said, well, you, Arnaldo, you just hire him then and have somebody make a map. And so when I showed up to Palenque, a late night tequila thing had turned into a job for me. So I got,
oh my God, Ed, are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. That's how it happened.
Okay.
Now, I was trained and I was a good person. I did a good job, but it was really, it was a late night tequila thing that made it happen.
So did INA was obviously there, and did INA fund your research and your survey time?
No, they did not. No, they did not. I found the money otherwise from a group called FAMSI, Foundation for the Advancement of Mesoamerican Studies.
So you wrote a grant.
Technically, I worked for INA because I was hired by Arnaldo Gonzalez Cruz, who was the chief archaeologist. They didn't pay me anything, but I was under his project that I did the work. So technically, I was working for INA.
Okay. So what was the layout or map leading up to your survey? What did we have? Was it something that had been basically charted based on early excavations of the civic area where the palaces and what did you have to start with as kind of a template?
Well, there were six or seven attempts at mapping Palenque before mine. And, each one of them had the city center with the palace and the temples pretty well worked out. It was the periphery and all of the buildings that were the rest of the city that nobody had really done a good job on. Franz Blom tried some in the 1930s, but basically he was tomb hunting, so he didn't care about making a good map. The best one that existed was still is in Merle Green Robertson's four-volume series called The Sculpture of Palenque. And she and Shealy and a number of other people went out there and made their best attempt at least making a rough map. They did a good job of putting in the rivers, and they put in some buildings here and there, but most of her map, amusingly, has big sections that just have text in them that say, unmapped but full of buildings. So so that was the best map before mine. They just say one that mostly said unmapped but full of buildings.
Okay.
So her map had 329 buildings on it. My map, when I ended the three-year project, had 1,181 buildings on it.
Triple that. Wow. Amazing. What year was this?
The project took place between 1998 and 2000.
2 years. Okay, so did you hire a professional surveyor who was familiar with how to connect the dots?
Ooh, you lost me on that last little part of it. But yes, I did hire a professional survey team that worked with me for the first 2 weeks of the project. They were a professional outfit out of Wisconsin. And I just learned, I knew something how to survey already, but I really wanted to know professionally how to survey. So I hired these guys just for 2 weeks. They helped me do the city center and a little bit of the outside, the stuff that was already the open park. And while we did that, I learned from them. It was like an intensive course on how to properly survey in professional standards.
Okay.
After that, it was just me.
Okay. So you got started with the pros, and you just, you knew enough to do it. This is the time there really wasn't any kind of, other than planes flying over and taking pictures. It wasn't LIDAR. High tech really hadn't come into the scene yet. Of course you had ground penetrating radar, but that doesn't help with surveying. What was the equipment you were using? It wasn't just scoping through a lens and having some guy a few hundred feet away holding a pole, was it?
Yeah, it was.
You're kidding me.
But not the old stripe, red and white striped pole thing. It was a laser theodolite. So it would bounce a laser out of the machine off of a prism on top of the rod and back. But that's how we had to do it. We actually mapped it twice. I do it first with pace and compass and a piece of graph paper, just kind of figure out where the buildings were around me. Because the jungle was so thick there, you can't see more than, you know, 10 feet away from you. You could be standing next to a pyramid that was 20 feet away and not see it. So step one was to figure out where the heck we were. And then with that, I'd plan out a route. I'd say, like, if we put the machine here, I can see six different buildings. Or don't bring the machine this way, there's a huge tree fall. And so then we bring the machine out, and we just laboriously over a 3-year period did just marched, you know, sometimes only meters of progress a day and got it done. In the end, we took 23,500 points of data.
Jesus Christ. computer technology wasn't necessarily in its strongest position then. So I imagine there was a lot of note writing and logging and things like that.
Well, I had a deep distrust of all the computer stuff, which was new and would fritz out in Palenque's electrical grid all the time. So we took notes on everything so we wouldn't lose things in a burnout. But we had, you know, we had technology. I had a laser theodolite. Connected to it was a Texas Instruments calculator, those old ones that you could take a cartridge in and out of. So it had a way to put a survey cartridge into it, and it would download all the data that I'd then take back to the field house every night and download it into software that was survey software and test it, make sure that everything was good. And then finally, I'd export that to AutoCAD, where I'd make the pretty maps.
Oh, AutoCAD, right. Oh, that's been around for a long time.
Yep. And so I had to learn all those things to make the map right. It was fun, though. I love learning new things. So I learned all those softwares and figured out how to dance. Nowadays, right, LIDAR can...
Well, LIDAR is such a game changer now that you wouldn't have to do anything else but just scan the area.
I can't wait for somebody to do a good LIDAR of Palenque so I can compare it to the map we made. Because I'm pretty sure that in, you know, 3 days they can do what took me 3 years. But I haven't seen it yet.
Well, that's weird, Ed. I could have sworn you said that they had done it already. Ina had actually done a scan of that whole local biosphere.
No, I have not seen it. I hope I'm one among the first to know when they do it.
Yeah, they should have.
Nobody's made a LIDAR map of Palenque yet, and I would so love to compare it to what took me 3 years. Mm. Hopefully they look the same.
question for you. Chichen Itza, Uxmal are considered and Tikal are considered very large cities. According to Wikipedia, and I'd rather ask you about this, but I needed to prepare for this interview. Wikipedia considers Palenque kind of a middle ground size city, not small, but not huge. What do you say after surveying?
I'd agree with that. I'd say it's a mid-sized city. I generally am a low ender when it comes to populations, population estimates. Our methods of calculating population are ridiculously simple. They're like per building, how many people per building calculations.
Oh, real rudimentary then.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, I mean, part of it is just the reality. We can't, if you we can't, could go out there and probe every building, then we'd have a better estimate, but we don't. So that's there's a really overly simplistic way we do it. But when you do the numbers versus my map, Palenque, you know, I put out in my dissertation that I think that the peak population was about 8,000 people. And that was a very unpopular idea, but that's what the numbers said. That's the math.
In private, you and I have mentioned that your map became a classic in many ways, very popular, and it's actually considered now, I think you mentioned that it's like the standard by all follow.
I wouldn't say that at all.
Well, but it's pretty well done. You did a good job.
I ended up, at the time that I made the map, it was kind of paradigm shifting that my use of color and the details and AutoCAD and the way I presented it became a model for future projects. Not every project for sure, but it was featured for a year in a German museum as an example of the finest kind of archaeological mapping. So I have the German exactitude seal of approval, which is important to me. I'm proud of that.
So help me see this map. And by the way, can we download it from your website?
Yep, you can. Okay. It's on a PDF too. You don't even need any software.
I'm going to post that on our Facebook page for those of you listening. We'll have Ed's Palenque map.
Please do for the world.
Yeah. Does this map have the heights of hills and what do they call that? Geological measurements?
Topographic lines. Yes, yeah. It does.
So that's pretty good. So this equipment back then could actually measure the height and width of hills as well as the actual buildings.
Whoa, heck, the Egyptians could do that, Cliff.
I'm just talking about this technology that you had then. So
yeah, the fundamentals of survey have, you know, never changed until we started doing it from the sky. So yes, it was just electronic versions of the same kind of survey equipment that have been used, you know, since Roman times at least.
Okay. Yeah. A little bit better than that. But yeah. Talk a little bit about the hydraulics.
The Romans probably would have gotten it done quicker. They would have put in a whole legion on it. It would have been quicker.
talk about the water system, the brilliance of the hydraulics in and out of buildings that you uncovered. And also, I'm trying to think of the name for the water capture underground. There's a term for it. I'm blanking out on it right now.
Chultun? You mean in the Maga or cistern?
Cistern. Thank you.
Yeah. I call them chultuns.
Okay. Well, the cisterns that I've seen at Uxmal are so amazing. And this is by itself is a work of engineering genius. Talk a little bit about what you uncovered in terms of a water system for many of the buildings at Palenque.
Okay. Well, I can say it with complete confidence that Palenque is the most complex hydraulic engineering in the entire Maya world. Those things at Uxmal, they're great. They were admirable, but the things that Palenque had to do to be Palenque were outrageous. There are seven big rivers running down the hill, springs everywhere. They had both an opportunity and a challenge. Nobody ever ran out of water at Palenque. The problem was that the water could wash them off the hillside. So there's a hell of a lot of engineering to keep it from washing off in the rainy seasons. 16 linear kilometers of terracing is keeping that city from being washed off by all this water. They had a rare challenge that they weren't trying to collect water. They were trying to control water, or it would end them. But they did so to their benefit by using all of those rivers. They would put in drains upriver and then cross it down through a neighborhood and out drain in the river to the left or right of it. So they would use gravity to put running water through every neighborhood. Everywhere I surveyed, there were running pipes. I could see them in patios often. If there were four buildings with a little interior patio, the break of its water line would be visible in the patio's floor. So that was everywhere. The Palenque's palace had the same sort of thing, water running into it and even pumping up to the second story. There are these two bathrooms. There are two toilets in the palace.
Oh, and you're kidding me. And water
gets pushed uphill to these toilets and then down out the other side.
So they had a sanitation system of some kind.
They did. I mean, it's amazing. And there are these pools. There are at least three different pools that were, one of them looks like a backyard pool of some rich guy's house. The other two are in more ceremonial contexts. My friend Dr. Kirk French did his master's on Palenque's hydrology, and it should also be accessible through my website. But I just saw him last week, and he was doing a presentation on Palenque's water. Mm-hmm. And he showed me something I didn't know that he had done, which was so neat. I know you're a fan of connecting modern Maya to ancient Maya. He excavated the pool in the old part of Palenque called Pacota. And it had 9 steps going down into the pool, just like the Maya underworld. But there was an intake and an outtake. So water would swirl into it and go back out. So it was always fresh water in there, accessed by 9 stairs. Then he goes up to the Maya highlands in Chamula near San Cristobal de las Casas. And they have 4 different shrines around the town that have these pools with 9 steps going down into them and an in and out thing. One of them is only used to clean religious clothes. One of them's only used one day a year for a festival that happens, I think he said, April 3rd. And there's another one that's kind of a plain Jane where everybody goes to wash their clothes. But the water always circulates, so it never gets dirty. But they walk down these 9 steps. And so modern-day Maya and Chamula are building the same kind of pools that Palenque was 1,500 years ago.
That's so amazing to hear that. What did they use? Oh, we talked about cisterns and other capture systems. The water, the rain season must be pretty brutal there. Like they have, 100 plus inches of rain? Not Palenque.
Oh, well, the rainy season. Yeah, the dry season, they have perennial water. Palenque has water all year long, no matter what. They didn't store any water. It just kept flowing.
Okay, so they're that close to the major rivers that they were able just to tap that and then draw it into the city?
No, actually, the beautiful thing is that it's all coming from the groundwater and springs. These rivers originate in Palenque, and then they feed down to a major river in the plains below them. Palenque's up on a hill.
Oh.
And the rivers come down and all these beautiful waterfalls and then feed the major river running through the valley in front of them. Or not the valley, the plains. Okay. That's the edge of the mountains. And then there's a river in front of them. And then it's flat plains all the way to the Gulf. But there's springs, tons of them. I mapped for sure 54 springs in the city. But there were many, many more for sure that I couldn't see.
Was there anything that you mapped that you found was, I mean, obviously this hydraulic system, as you call it, is the most sophisticated of all the ancient cities. But was there anything else that you discovered that you thought was exceptional about Palenque? Because, I mean, obviously, if it's 3,000 years old, that's a long time to really get your engineering to a fine point.
Yeah. there are certainly, you know, there are common houses that didn't stand the test of time as well as the temples. The Palenque's, Pakal and Khanbalam's temples were incredible. They were using some sort of cement to put them together, or mortar, I should say, not cement, between the stones that held them together better than ever. So that's a wonder. And you can see it clearly. There's a building that Pakal built way away from the city center, and it's surrounded in buildings that have just completely toppled, and it's standing there like they built it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful thing. It's called the Olvidado.
I hope we get to see that in November.
I will bring you to the Olvidado. We were talking just the other day, those two lost tourist girls that I found out in the woods.
They were sitting
on the steps of the Olvidado. They found the one temple that was still standing, and they were just sitting there waiting for someone to save them because they had no idea where they were. But I knew where they were. I got them out, and you and I's group will get in and out of there fine. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So just real quickly, there's a civic area that's kept pretty much open, and the lawns are mowed by the keepers. And so, and then apparently it sounds like it becomes jungle all of a sudden, and it's probably easy to get lost. Is that what you're suggesting?
Very easy. There's nothing but footpaths, and if you don't maintain them, they just get swallowed by the jungle in days. So if you follow too many paths, you quickly lose your orientation and where the heck you are, because it goes out for, you know, more than a kilometer. We'll walk all through those areas. There's so many standing walls still and evidence of the hydraulic engineering. There's also the largest building. You were asking me what's the thing that really surprised me. The fact that a kilometer away from the palace, which was always the largest building in Palenque, I found a larger building. I found a building bigger than the palace.
Is it just noted as building two on the map?
No, I got to name it. It's called the Escondido. That means hidden in Spanish.
I thought it would be like El Barnhart or something.
No, you're not going to have to do that anymore. I would never do that if I had cancer. I called it the hidden. And it's still hidden. It was funny. I was out there a month or two ago, and I went out with some Maya guides who live there and are jungle guides. And I said, bring us to the biggest building. And they were like, what are you talking about? I was like, it's right in there. But the guy who owns the land has hidden all the trails again. And he doesn't want anybody in Palenque to know it's there, because if it's too much of a stink, the government's gonna kick him off the land, because he does have the biggest building. I was actually on purpose riling up the Maya at the end. I was like, that guy out there, what's his name? Don Hever, old guard, right? What's he doing holding on to that? I was like, I knew the answer. I was like, is Don Hever a Maya? And they were like, no, he's not. I was like, well, what the hell is a Maya doing with a private ownership of the biggest building in Palenque?
Don't you guys think
you should do something about that? So hopefully by the time we get there, I'll have kicked down the gate and we'll go up to that big building too.
What is it? What's unique about the building? Is it as sophisticated as the palace with the tower and his ornate stairways, or is it more covered up?
That's one of the interesting things about it. It is a plain Jane big platform. It's so big that the top of it is about the size of a football field.
Jesus.
It's a huge building. It's about 10 meters up to that level. And then there's a little part that juts out over the there's cliffs that fall down off of there about 100 meters down to the plain. So it has this beautiful view of the whole plains. And there's a building up there that's L-shaped, a little one. But what I think is that it is encapsulating the early palace of Palenque. You know how we were just talking about how they bury buildings and they put a platform over it and then things on top?
Yeah.
There are a number of reasons that I believe that it's a cap that is capping the early palace of Palenque. We know that the first four kings of Palenque weren't crowned in the city center as we know it. They were crowned in another part of the city that the hieroglyphs call Toktan. The city center is called Lakam Ha, and there's one monument that tells us that the uh, that the fourth king was crowned in Toktan and then built Lakamha. So somewhere in the city, or maybe outside the city, is a older palenque. And to me, the best candidate is that giant building. I think it's encapsulating like a tomb for a building.
Yeah.
I think an old palace is inside.
We've talked about this before, Ed, and I've noticed it in Uxmal and also Koba. It's tough on the Mexican government to do anything than just excavate the civic centers of these cities because their buildings are more exposed. It's easier to clean them up and then opening them to the public. But, you know, when you see a pyramid that's huge standing in front of you that hasn't been excavated, it must be frustrating as hell. I know I've been frustrated because, like, it could be, you know, unearthed and excavated properly, it could reveal some really important data.
Oh, it really could. I'm convinced that whole area that also involves a big aqueduct and the pool I was talking about, it's called the Pocota area. That's the last part. That's the end of any other map before mine. And then, funny enough, like it's like 50 meters away is this pyramid. I think the early researchers just thought it was a mountain.
Jesus, is that
so damn big? I think that even Franz Blom was fooled and said that can't be a building, but it was.
Yeah,
but you know, it's still private owned land by this guy, and I'm not scared to say it, Don Heber. Give Mexico your land. That's not yours anymore. You'll be well compensated. Beat it, man.
You're gonna get an email from him.
I don't care. Come on, I tried to show up to his house with a bottle of rum. He's a jerk.
Does he live on the grounds?
No. He's got Maya people, which is part of the whole spider web. I don't want to kick that nice little family.
Oh God, yeah, I hear you.
But they're all like, Don Heber says you're not allowed to be here. That was you know, years ago. But it is a challenge that it's not even Ina's land at the moment. They've got to fairly compensate him. It's a kilometer out from there. It's going to be and it's a huge building. Yeah. I did actually suggest in the end of my dissertation how to test pit it and around and at least fully determine that it's the oldest building. And then we could go from there. It wouldn't be that hard to at least probe what my theory is, but I was lucky as a gringo to be allowed to play in Ina's sandbox at all. I sent them a report saying what I thought the next steps were, and they were like, that's a great idea, Ed. We'll handle that.
Funny. I should let our listeners know that we'll be joining Ed in November. Our tour is November 10th through the 17th. It's real short, but it's intense. We're going to do a lot of stuff. More information.
We're going to have a good time.
Oh, have a great time. Earth Ancients, for more information, earthancients.com/tours. Look for the Mexico banner. Click on it and sign up. We're getting full, so don't wait too long. We got a few months, but it's going to be fun with Ed. Hey, as we conclude, Ed, what is the most impressive aspect of Palenque, and why is it I would consider it your first love in the world of Maya cities?
Well, gosh, that's again, you know, like trying to get me to pick my favorite kid or something. I mean,
I feel the same way. I got to pin you to the wall a little bit because obviously you spent a considerable time there.
Well, you know, I'll go with the underappreciated one. The fact that that city, you know, its last whisper was 800 CE. So the last time anybody mowed the lawn there was 1,200 years ago. Wow. And yet it remains. It's built into a hillside in the rainforest. It should have washed away long ago. And if it wasn't for the 16 linear kilometers of massive terracing, it would have washed off. And nobody ever sees that terracing when you just take a regular trip of Palenque. But what I'm going to do for you and your group is bring you back out into the woods, and we will track these massive over our heads terraces for hundreds of meters.
Let me stop you real quickly. When you say terracing, these are retaining walls, right?
No, they're into the hillside. So they're
cement slabs.
No. They're built of stone.
Okay.
But they have features that allow the groundwater not to build up too high, hard behind them and blow them out. And they've got they are the way that Palenque kept itself on this beautiful hillside around all these waterfalls. They're the key. They need more investigation, really. I think they're a combination of controlling impervious cover runoff, but also drainage systems underneath that don't allow the torrential rains to soak the ground and break the walls out. They're all usually at a bit of a pitch. Some of them are straight up, but I've documented hundreds of photos of still standing parts of them. And we're talking 1,200 years of rainy seasons pounding on these things, and they're still standing.
And these are master engineers that are behind this kind of technology, don't you think?
And it's beyond what a family or even a group of families could do. This was city public works infrastructure that was built and maintained for its population.
Wow. Fantastic. As always, Dr. Edwin Barnhard, a pleasure to have you on and to explain. I'm looking forward to journeying with you to Palenque. It must be like coming home every time you head out there.
You know, I it's funny. I am kind of a rock star there. I had a good relationship with everybody. So I'll have to spend a lot of time shaking hands and taking pictures with people, but I'll have plenty of time for you, and we're going to have a great time. I'm so excited to be the person that shows you Palenque. Not just Palenque, too. Bonampak and Yaxchilan
are going to
blow you away.
And we've already talked about the first stop, which is La Venta, when this amazing outdoor museum we're going to check out, and some Olmec sites as well. So that's going to be great.
Well, so, you know, I don't mean to cheat on Palenque, but Yaxchilan is absolutely one of my favorite sites in the whole Maya world. It is so romantic and beautiful.
That's higher up the hill, isn't it?
No, we got to take a boat for an hour up the Usumacinta River. And then that's the only way to access it. There are no roads. And then we climb up from the river into the site.
Oh, my God. Amazing. Okay. I didn't even know that. Okay.
You're signed up now, pal. I got you on the list.
Can't get out of it. Sounds good. No. Hey, Ed, thanks again. Always fun talking with you. And we'll be in touch. We'll see you next time.
Sounds great. Thanks, Cliff.
Real good to have Ed on the program. Has he mentioned our tour in November? It's November 10th through the 17th. And you can get more information and register by going to earthancients.com/tours, T-O-U-R-S. You'll see the entire itinerary. And I've been talking about it now for a few months. And we have 12 people. We don't want to go or have more than 25. So you still have time to get on board and to join us. Now, I'm really not only excited about visiting Palenque, but we'll definitely be doing interviews with Ed and asking him for his opinions of certain temples and pyramids. One of the things he mentioned to me off record, before we started interviewing, was a number of trails that he will be leading tours on of areas that have not been really looked at very closely, have not been excavated, that he bumped into when he was surveying the entire facility. And one of the things about Mayan archaeology or Mayan city design is that on the periphery, on some of the outer edges, there's sometimes temples or pyramids of great size. And we find this in Uxmal, where we see a huge pyramid that you think is a hill because it hasn't been touched, but it's an unexcavated pyramid. We see the same thing in Palenque. We see this all over the place. There's just a small percentage of these noted cities that has been excavated. And it's kind of, well, it's a challenge if you really want to know more about these sites, because just a fraction has been exposed for observation and study. And it's just the way it is in Mexico. Mexico is not necessarily a wealthy country and doesn't have the resources to completely excavate these places. So although Ed has done a great job in mapping these sites and surveying these sites, these cities, there's a great deal that still needs to be excavated and revealed to the general public and to the archaeologists out there. So I'm going to be posting the complete map that Ed finished many years ago for you to look at. You can see it on Facebook. Go to Earth Ancients and look at it under either the group page or the international page. It'll be on both of those. And if you're not in the social media, just go to earthancients.com and find the Facebook feed link, and you can download it there. He showed me a copy of the map, which is a PDF now. And when you convert it to a PDF, you can actually enlarge or reduce it in size. So he showed me a 11 by 17 sheet of paper that he had printed at a local print shop. So that's one way to look at it, and that's how I plan to download it myself, is to take an 11 by 17 sheet of paper and enlarge it and drop it into that. So fun to have him on the program. Hey, we still have a few spots left on the Grand Egyptian Tour. That is coming up real soon, May 2nd to the 14th, 2023. We all meet in Cairo. That is 100% private. And what I mean that by that is that when we get on the bus, I think it's 80% of the places we go to are private tours, meaning that no general public, no interference from anybody. We have the place to ourselves. And this is what makes the Grand Egyptian Tour really, really spectacular and worth your consideration. We're going to be going to the Cheops Pyramid, the Grand Pyramid, by ourselves, without the general public, for 2+ hours. This means you can climb through the pyramid. You can go to the Queen's Chamber, the King's Chamber. We've even opened up the subterranean chamber, which is this. It's about 300 yards from the surface that you go down into. And there's a great deal of question about the subterranean chamber, because it looks like there's been water erosion down there. It looks like there was, I mean, there's a lot of theories that it was a pump for the pyramid, that the pyramid was a big engine of some kind. We just don't know. But you can actually go down into this chamber, film to your heart's content, and do your own personal meditations or research, whatever, while we are in this great pyramid. For more information on the Grand Egyptian Tour, go to earthancients.com/tours. Look for the banner for Egypt. Click on it. You can see the entire itinerary. And if you want to join us, register, get your deposit in, and away you go. We're going to have a group meeting in a couple of weeks where we can all talk. You can ask questions. We'll be meeting via Zoom. And that's one of two meetings we'll have prior to meeting in Cairo on May 2nd. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, last year was great, but each year we go, there's something unique, something outstanding to see. And it's just a wonderful trip. For more information, earthancients.com/tours. Hey, I want to mention we have a YouTube channel. It's called Earth Ancients Official. A lot of the interviews we've been doing over the years have been converted to video presentations. And a lot of them, I'd say half. Well, no, let's say 200 or 300 at this point. We're still working on getting them up for you to see the actual presenter. But a lot of them have people holding artifacts, holding photos, illustrations, graphs, whatever. that really makes the interview kind of come to life. So if you're interested in seeing these interviews, go to YouTube and punch in Earth Ancients Official. That is our new page. Just launched a few weeks ago, and people say they like it. That's great to hear. And we're continually building on it. We're converting old audios into videos and back and forth. So check it out. Let me know what you think. And that's another way to get Earth Ancients. If you're not really into the audio, you'd rather see it, check it out there. Earth Ancients Official on YouTube. All right, that's it for this week's program. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Edwin Barnhard, coming to us from Austin, Texas. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everyone else who makes this thing happen. You guys rock! You really do, and I appreciate your help. All right, take care, be well, and we will talk to you next time. Beep.